On this week's episode, I chat to crime writer and favourite author of mine, Liz Nugent. Known for her books Unravelling Oliver, Lying in Wait and Skin Deep, Liz has quickly made a name for herself in recent years for quality Irish crime writing. In this episode, we discuss the necessity of making your psychopaths somewhat likeable, the wonder of Marion Keyes, and her favourite book turned films.
You're going to hear the excitement in my voice throughout this episode because basically I'm just like a super fan of yours. So
that's great. Love super fans. Come and live with me if you like.
Hold on. Yeah. Stuart is shaking his head here like, don't say that to her, she actually will. I'm here with Liz Nugent for the Books That Made Me podcast. So thank you very, very much, Liz, for agreeing to do this.
You're welcome.
Much appreciated. So I'm going to bring us back to the start and see if you can tell me a little bit about the first book you remember buying.
I have a very distinct memory of buying my first book because I was on holidays. My family rented a little cottage in Glenbey in County Kerry. And we all had, I think we all kind of saved up holiday money or something. So so I might have had a pound or something.
Yeah.
But Dad was at home, so we had to buy Dad a present. That was kind of the thing. So you had to spend some of your holiday money. So I had probably, 40p left.
Yeah.
This would have been in the early 70s, I would say. And so I went to a bookshop and I bought the first book that was, because I at this stage, I had only had picture books up until then. And I just always found that there wasn't enough story in them, that I ran out of story too quickly. There was all pictures and, you know, I love the pictures, but I wanted more story.
Yeah.
So I found a book in a bookshop called The Shoe Shop Bears by Margaret J. Baker. And I bought that book and read it until it fell apart and, you know, read it and reread it and reread it. And it was about three bears that worked in a shoe shop, and they were given to kids who are fidgety or nervous or whatever. But at night when the shoe store closed, they came alive, whatever. And the only people who realized that they were alive was the young 16-year-old girl who worked in the shop.
Okay.
So that was my first book, and I lost it somewhere along the way, as you do growing up, but I refound it because it went out of print. I went looking for it when, you know, Amazon came up, and, you know, I couldn't find it in any bookshop. I tried to track it down because I wanted to give it to nephews and nieces, but it's completely out of print. But I did find a copy of it from a library in Cleveland, Ohio, who were dumping their stock.
No way.
So I managed to get it secondhand. So I now own a copy of it again.
That's incredible, isn't it?
And that shows the attachment I had to that first book. And it was like, there was like a few tiny illustrations, but most of it was text.
You do, though, form such an intense attachment to those initial books. I have this book and I still can't remember the name of it. If anyone actually knows it, please tell me, because I just remember the storyline being about this magic chair that children got into, and then it took them to another world high above the clouds, and they'd get into all sorts of adventures and things in there, and then they'd come back down.
I don't know that one, but it sounds like the story I made up in Unraveling Oliver. Maybe I read that book you're talking about and plagiarized it.
You're fine. I can't even remember what the book name is. And anytime I say it to someone, they don't know what it is. So yours is much better. But you do. You form this really intense attachment to these things. That's incredible. So are you keeping the book for yourself?
Oh yeah, it's not, because you can't get copies to give to other people.
And you can't just pick one niece or nephew to look. Like, even if you have a favourite, you're not allowed to.
I mean, I did, like, when I finish a book, I treat myself and I buy myself a present. And last year, the year before last, when I finished Skin Deep, I bought myself an early edition of Oscar Wilde's Children's Stories.
Oh, beautiful.
So.
That's so nice. And is it always a book you buy yourself?
No.
Kinderberry.
No, this year it was Two Nights in Paris Court Hotel.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Definitely, whatever the soul needs at that time.
Exactly.
Brilliant. So what about then the first book you remember kind of teaching you about friendship or family?
I think the second book that taught me anything really in terms of life was Cider House Rules by John Irving.
Oh, such a good book.
Particularly you know, I was thinking about it a lot last year during the Repeal the Eighth campaign, because it's about a guy who runs an orphanage and an abortion clinic side by side. And it's about the boy who grows up in that. Sorry, do you want me to start again or answer that again? Okay.
That's life, as I say. It's just life stuff happens.
So it's about the boy who grows up in this situation. And I just found it enormously humane. It was it showed John Irving's humanity throughout the book, that he looked at both sides and was willing to take women in any situation, whether they wanted to stay and have their babies and place them for adoption, or whether they wanted to abort.
Yeah.
That he was, Wilbur Larch, I think was the name of the character, Dr. Wilbur Larch, that he was willing to accept all women, no matter what their situation was.
Yeah.
And I loved the kind of setting of it, St. Cloud in Maine, I think.
Yeah.
Or New Hampshire, is it Maine? I think it's Maine.
I thought it was Maine, yeah.
But yeah, I loved that. That was a book that taught me about life and choices, and, you know, because I don't think I ever discussed abortion or abortion rights in my family.
Yeah.
But that book helped me come to an understanding of choice.
He treats it with such a compassionate perspective and lens that he's approaching it from. It allows you to kind of maneuver through and have a think and then come to your own opinions about it, absolutely. Which is really nice. But I think it's also so important as well for... like, I'm pro-choice, and I always find there's a lack of compassion on the other side of the debate. Or at least that's how it feels to me.
Well, I can see, actually.
Yeah.
Like, my dad would have been a no voter, and his compassion was for the little babies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, when you put it like that, but I was saying, but Dad, you know, what about the women?
Yeah.
And he would be saying, oh, no, that's just a few hard cases. And I was going, but they're actually real women's lives. And I just couldn't convince him of it. So we just agreed to park the conversation and we just wouldn't discuss it again, because I do want to continue talking to my dad. Yeah. I almost fell out with two brothers over it.
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, that whole thing brought up so many emotions and so much tension.
It certainly divided my family down the middle. Yeah. It was awful.
Yeah.
Awful.
Can completely understand that. Yeah. That book, though, it's so funny that you mention it, because in my second book I'm writing at the moment, two of the characters grow their friendship out of swapping books with each other, and that book is one of the books that the character gives to the other. And that
let's see if I can name the other one.
we go through this. You're having a psychic moment. Okay, then what about a book that broke your heart? Now, this could either be because it had an unsatisfactory ending, or a character died, or for whatever reason just kind of left you bereft.
I think The Butcher Boy
by
Pat McCabe broke my heart, because he was such a broken child. And he had such a... I think in the beginning his mother is taken off to an asylum and then she's dead, and his father is just an alcoholic who drinks all the time, and then he's very much on his own. He has nobody, and the only friend he has is called Philip Nugent. And the book starts off, the opening line is, "The whole town is after me on account of what I've done on Mrs. Nugent." And, you know, so I feel it's sort of a kinship, even though the Mrs. Nugent character was quite the baddie in it, and Philip had been his only friend. But then when Mrs. Nugent saw how Francie Brady was behaving, she split up that friendship and she separated them. And I'm actually writing a draft of a film script at the moment about what happens 60 years after an event like that, when two friends are separated and the reasons why. But like, it broke my heart, because nobody really helped him. He was just sort of, he went from one situation of dysfunction to another of abuse, and you know, there seemed to be really no redemption for him. And then he ends up psychopathically murdering No, I don't want to say who in case people haven't read it yet.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, he does turn into a, like, he, because of, I don't think people are born evil. I just don't, I don't believe it, which is why in my books you'll see that I always explain why characters become the way they become. And I think with Francie Brady, he was definitely a product of all of the circumstances that he grew up with.
But I think it always makes it so much more interesting when you have that nuance in the characters, because it's a lot more simplistic to write someone as either simply good or bad. But the reality is we're all capable of certain different things. Did you find reading stories like that intrigued kind of more your own interest in those stories?
Yeah, I'm very drawn to stories about psychopaths and sociopaths. I loved The Book of Evidence by John Banville.
So good.
I loved Enkelby by Sebastian Fuchs. Even Any Human Heart by William Boyd. Now, and I'm very conscious of the fact that nearly all the writers I mention are male. But when I was growing up, it was the male writers that got all the attention.
Exactly.
So, you know, and another book that was a huge influence on me was by Marion Keyes. Rachel's Holiday by Marion Keyes is one of the funniest. But also a very serious topic about addiction that is dealt with in such a serious but lighthearted way. And she really gets to the bones of, you know, what it is like to be an addict and to be in denial about it, you know, and then come to accept the truth and that life has to change. So, yeah, it's not all men. And it's not all serious literature. I do read kind of broadly and I read lots of different types of book.
You do, though. You have to absorb all the different pieces together to put the story in. I find it so interesting. Again and again, Marion Keyes and Rachel's Holiday in particular comes up as an influence for so many Irish writers. And it's so interesting because it defies whatever genre they're in. It's such a testament to her that she has such a way of portraying people and emotions and situations kind of in a complexity. But
and she deals particularly well with Irish families.
Oh, God.
Because, you know, Irish families are traditionally big. There's nine of us. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
So, and all of the different personalities within a family that, you know, that everybody has to get their speak in. And, you know, so everybody has an opinion and in my family, you know, things would have been chaotic. Like if you didn't speak up, you didn't get. So consequently, as adults, we all talk across each other all the time, which is very annoying for my husband's Protestant Belfast family.
They don't understand it at all.
There's only three of them and they're very polite and they all take turns to talk. I don't understand
that. I don't get
all.
That. Who does it's, that?
Well, Belfast Protestants, I think.
There were only four of us in our family and we still did that.
They just have manners up there.
Oh,
we
that's
don't.
Very nice. It's always so nice, though, when you see your representation of your family in different things. Like, Anne Enright was a revelation for me in that regard.
She's amazing.
God, she's unreal. But, like, reading her books and going, just getting that nub of Irishness distinctly of family dynamics that, like, if, when you try, and I don't know if you've ever done this, but trying to explain it to people outside of Ireland, those little mannerisms or way it has to be done, or,
Absolutely.
Oh no, my mommy always has to do this when I come in, you know, they'd be like, what? I don't get this at all.
It's true.
So then your interest in those kind of psychopathic and psychotic characters, are they always fictional or is there any kind of varying into true stories? Are you ever interested in reading those?
Yeah, I mean, I would follow trials, you know, even the awful Graham Doerr. I followed that trial perhaps more vividly than I, or more, I followed it deeply. There's a word. I'm a writer, but I've run out of words.
If you're angry like me, I was a bit obsessed with it.
But I was a little bit obsessive about it. And I listened to all of the news reports. I followed the people who were tweeting it live from the court. Because it was so horrific and so awful. But I couldn't write that kind of crime. Like I can't write about, I've no interest in writing about sex crimes or child sexual abuse crimes. I can write very well about neglect or dysfunctional families, but the kind of rape and the visceral stuff. Yeah. I can't really go there. It's just
it's always too
much for me, and I don't particularly like reading about it either. You know,
it's really hard, I think, to even do that well, because so often I find it in books I'm reading, and it's not necessarily something I feel is needed.
Yeah.
And I think it's much more interesting playing out the dynamics without those elements into it, and kind of life is unfortunately filled enough with that.
There are loads of particularly female crime writers who do it extremely well, like Irish Jane Casey.
Yeah,
She's based in London, but like she has a whole series, the Maeve Kerrigan series of crime detective novels, and she deals with the subject so sensitively because she really, you get the sense that Jane as a person really, really cares about her victims, and that she really, she really wants to get to the nub of, you know, of who they were. It's not really just about catching the body who did the crime. It's really about who these women were before they were killed and what their lives were like. So there's a lot of Sarah Hillary is also one of the great English crime writers, does it in the same way. There's a lot of good writing around that subject as well.
Yeah.
I just personally can't go there.
That's completely understandable.
Yeah.
What about the book then that made you know yourself a little better?
Let me think. That's a tough one. I think I like books that aren't about people like me, because I think I'm pretty boring. I think I'm pretty dull, you know. And there aren't, like, before I was writing books, I was just a drone working in an office, and I don't think I'd like to read a book about a drone working in an office. I think I like to read books that aren't about people like me. Like, the big hit last year was Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine. And that was about somebody who worked in an office. And she was slightly odd, you know, but in a really lovely way.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a really cute novel. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I can't say that it spoke to me on a personal level.
Yeah.
As much as I really loved it.
That book was so lovely, though. I literally
wasn't it? It was just a delight.
I gave it away to people at Christmas, you know, going like, you have to read this. And like that, there, you know, there's not a whole lot I have in common with Eleanor, but she was such a lovable character.
She was just adorable. You just wanted to mind her and make sure that, and hope that she was okay.
Exactly. You just wanted to take care of her and kind of make her a cup of tea and sit her down and
look after her.
That book, though, I mean, I actually have gone back and read it again. And
I read it on my holidays.
It's just... it's
just a joy.
The feeling that she actually, the author, Gail, managed to create, I think.
The empathy she creates, because she made her character so vulnerable.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, it's one of the first things I learned about writing is that when you make your character vulnerable, you can win audience sympathy for them, no matter what they've done. So even though Oliver, in Unraveling Oliver, beats his wife into a coma by the first page, by the end of the book, the reader will have some compassion for him. They won't, and they absolutely shouldn't, condone what he's done.
Yeah.
But they might understand how he got there.
I remember when I read that book for the first time, and I was so sure going through, you know, I hate him and he's such a terrible person. And when I got to the end and when I really understood him, he's a terrible person, but probably in the wrong circumstances, we can all become terrible people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's when good characters make bad decisions, that's when you get your plot.
But I think that, like, I don't think... It definitely wouldn't have been as good a story if it was just, he was just bad and that, you know, and that was it. You would have, because straight from the beginning, you would have been like, okay, well, I hope you get your comeuppance, you know, bye. And it listed such complicated feelings in you, but that's the sign of a really good book, you know.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people would say that they never had any sympathy for him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, all the way through the book. And that's fine too, because I don't decide what the reader thinks.
Yeah.
But I know what I think. And I think he was an absolute bastard for what he did to his wife. But I think given his upbringing and what he had been through and all of the mistakes that he made, and then trying to cover his tracks and then living a lie for such a long time. I don't think he could have been any other way.
Yeah.
You know.
It's quite amazing to hear you speak about your characters, because you speak about them in such a real way.
I do feel I know them.
But that obviously then translates to the writing and the books, and what makes them so strong is, you know, because they're so real for you. Do you find that even as you're writing them? That
Funny enough, the characters in Unraveling Oliver, I feel closer to, because I've had them in my life for longer than like any of the characters in Skin Deep or the current one that I'm writing. Even the one that I'm writing now, I keep forgetting their names because I've only just finished writing. It's not going to be out till next year, but because I've only just finished writing it, I keep forgetting their names because I keep changing their names. So I'm like, oh, what's the name of the wife again? Oh yeah, Susan. Oh no, change that to Suzanne. Did I? I'm certainly, and I often catch myself wondering what Barney and Eugene are up to, you know, the characters from Unraveling Oliver who end up living together at the end of the book.
Would you be ever tempted to kind of write that story?
No, and I was tempted at one stage to just slip them into another book as incidental characters.
Yeah.
But I know Wally Lamb did that with I Know This Much Is True. And then with The Hour I First Believed, he put in that the main character as just a local painter and decorator. But he was just a background character. And I just thought, oh, it didn't really work, you know. So I just kind of thought, no, I'll just leave them where they were.
Leave them where they are and kind of let everyone imagine how their life would be. What about then a book that taught you about grief or loss?
Oh, grief and loss. The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion.
Yeah.
It has to be up there with, and it's a book that talks so brilliantly about it, but also I don't think it's a book you should give to people in the immediate aftermath. Mm-hmm. Like, I've given it to people who have suffered bereavement. Mm-hmm. But I would usually wait 6 months to a year.
Yeah.
Because it's very raw. Yeah. It's written from a very raw point of view. But it's beautifully written.
Yeah.
And it's, it's a bit,
I think you are right, though. You have to come to it at the right moment in time. Because I read it after my dad died, but it probably wasn't until about a year and a half after my dad died.
I think that's plenty of time, really.
Yeah, and I don't know if in the immediate weeks afterwards, and I distinctly remember actually going to Dunleary Library, because this is how I deal with things, you know. I research things and I plan it out, and I distinctly remember going to Dunleary Library to try and find as many books as I could about grief or loss, as if they could teach me how to live and how to cope with this. And like, if I'd come across that book, it wouldn't have taught me anything. It just would have probably made everything hurt a little bit more.
There's another one by Isabel Allende. I can't remember what it's called. About our daughter's illness.
Oh, I have heard about that one.
Oh, I can't remember. But that struck a chord as well. It's just interesting that the two books we're talking about that deal with grief and loss are both by women.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's because they were talking about real grief and they weren't fictional.
Yeah.
You know,
it's from a very raw place, and especially Joan Didion, she can always write from there. Her writing is just incredible, I find.
I mean, you can actually, you know, they talk about heartstrings, but you can actually feel each string of your heart when you're reading that book, because it is so, so raw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really, really does tug at you.
Yeah. Next question, because I'm going to cry.
Oh, sorry. What about then, is there a book that you read again and again?
Pride and Prejudice. Again and again and again.
Okay, tell me why.
Just because it's hilarious. It is, it's a very easy read. You know, the language. You know, somebody said to me recently, oh my God, I couldn't go back into that Victorian language. But actually, it's really straightforward. I mean, there's no big words.
Yeah.
The language is old fashioned, but it's not terribly formal.
No, it's very accessible.
Yeah, it's very accessible. And it's just very, very funny.
Mm.
And Pride and Prejudice is one I'd pick up again and again. The other one, because there is so much story, is one I just mentioned, I Know This Much Is True by Wally Lamb. Because there's so much story in it that, you know, the whole thing with the grandfather's story. Was he his grandfather? Mm. And the grandmother and the diaries and the ex, like every single character in that book has an epic story of their own. Mm. Like none of those characters are ciphers for each other. Yeah. They all have epic, epic stories of their own. Even the Native American character, you know, who's just a minor guy who does a bit of work with. He has an epic story about how his land or his tribal land was taken away from his ancestors and how, you know, that fight is going on to get it back all at the same time, which ties into the Italian background of the main character. So, yeah, that's a story. It's kind of a desert island book story because, you know, there's plenty of, there's eating and drinking in that book.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
So much story in it, yeah.
Those books are always the best that you can go back in and pull more off each time. Absolutely, it's brilliant. Yeah. Okay, and then I want to ask about, apart from your books, which I personally think would be fantastic on the screen, I think I've sent this to you previously, tweeting at you. If anyone wants to turn Liz's books into a film or limited series, plenty of material there. But is there a book that you've read and went, oh, I'd love if they turned that into a film?
Loads. I mean, they did turn my favourite book into a film. And I got to introduce it at the Dublin Film Festival this year. Well, certainly in my top five books of all time was Perfume by Patrick Susskind, which is about a serial killer who is obsessed by the sense of smell. Mm. But once again, it tells his whole story from boyhood to manhood. Yeah. And you learn why. You learn it's a why, don't why does he do this? Yeah. And his obsession. And when you read the book, you would think this is unfilmable. But Tom Tykwer, a German director, was just determined and he did a magnificent job. Like every single frame of that film is so beautiful to look at. You can almost smell it. You know, it's just incredible. But of other books, let me see. I think The Secret History is being made into a film.
Yes.
I did hear.
By
Donna Tartt.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
So, yeah, by time. That's only 20 years to go. And I think that will make a wonderful film if they're getting the casting right.
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything except that they've got the green light.
Yeah.
I think The Book of Evidence by John M. Granville would make an excellent film.
Yeah.
I think, actually, one I've just read recently, The Lost Man by Jane Harper.
Oh,
the
one set
in the Australia Nightback.
Oh, yes,
yeah,
sorry.
That would make a splendid film. Yeah,
that'd be brilliant.
Because you've got all of those landscapes and this kind of loner character.
That beautiful, vivid
and
imagery.
Why he's a loner and why he has removed himself from society and how he gets dragged back in. It's a wonderful book. God, there's loads. I'd love to see the whole Maeve Kerrigan series by Jane Casey made into. She'd be a perfect, you know, like Happy Valley, this her Lancashire character. Sally Wainwright did such a brilliant job at writing and directing those. But Jane Casey's books are ripe for TV drama, I think, for a police procedural series.
And there's definitely an appetite there for it.
Who else can I think of now? Anything kind of set in beautiful places, you know what I mean? Anything set around the Riviera or, you know.
Somewhere exotic and glamorous.
Exotic and glamorous, I love that. I loved the adaptation of the Patrick Melrose books because even though Edward St. Aubyn had such a horrific life, it looked very pretty on screen.
So glamorous.
It looked so beautiful.
Yeah. Benedict Cumberbatch swanting around and the villas.
But really horrific.
Yeah.
horrific, but pretty, you know?
Yeah.
Very pretty, it's
the glamorization of it.
I think one of my favorite films also, Perfume being such a beautiful, visually beautiful film to look at, is The Talented Mr. Rippey, which is adapted very closely from Patricia Highsmith's book, which
is
absolutely, I mean... unfortunately, Anthony Minghella is dead because I'd love him to direct one of my books. there is a little interest in film interest in my books at the moment, but I don't really want to talk about it because, until I'm in Savoy One with my popcorn. Oh no, Savoy One is gone now, isn't it?
But
okay, until I'm in the cinema with my popcorn, watching my film on the screen, I don't believe it's going
to
happen.
I'm not really a churchgoer, but I'll go in and I'll light as many candles as I can find to get it to happen, because I would personally love for it to happen.
Yeah, me too. We'll see.
Fingers crossed. Well, we're kind of actually coming to the end now. I feel like it's gone so quickly, but it's probably because I'm just in awe sitting here. So I want to ask you about the next books you plan on reading or you'd like to read.
The one I'm reading at the moment is called Three Little Truths by Ethna Shortle, Irish writer.
Oh, yes.
I'm thoroughly enjoying it. It's about a family neighbourhood of a cul-de-sac, and it's all the families that live there. And one family has moved from Limerick under kind of sinister circumstances. You don't quite know what has happened. There was a tiger kidnapping, or was there? And also the school. So all of the children who live in this cul-de-sac go to the same school, and the headmistress of the school is one of the neighbours.
Okay.
And there's funny things going on at the school as well. So I'm thoroughly enjoying that. And next on my list, I think, is The Firestarters by Jan Carson.
Yes.
I just I saw her talk at the Listowel Writers Festival, and she was hugely impressive. And I think we in the South kind of have a mental block about books set or written about Belfast, because I think for us growing up, all we ever saw about the North on the news were bad news stories about bombings and whatever. And she does tackle that situation in her book, but I think it's sort of incumbent upon us, particularly with Brexit hurtling towards us, to understand more about our northern neighbours, because it does seem to me like maybe we have more in common with people who live in Liverpool than people who live 100 miles up the road. So I'm determined to read that. I did read Paul McVeigh's book, The Good Son, set in Belfast, and I got a huge amount out of that. And also my husband's from there, so I should...
Trying to understand.
Yeah, but he pretty much refuses to read anything set in Belfast. I'm trying to educate myself a little on that subject.
Well, those are excellent books to be reading anyway. Liz, thank you so very, very much for doing this podcast.